Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Good morning. Good morning.
I apologize for my attire this morning, but I'm going to have to do a surgical case here in about 30 minutes or so. And I am bereft of my normal JBJS garb and background. And my, you know, priceless Ortho Joe mug has been left behind. So I'm feeling a little bit out of sorts here. But I know that you can carry the discussion. You've got yours.
Oh, I've got mine.
And Dr. Sharda, if you're going to get this priceless Ortho Joe mug.
Yeah. Amazing. It's going to give me a lot of credibility as an anesthesiologist when I go into the lounge in the OR with my Ortho Joe mug. There we go.
just be sure you never take your eyes off, because people want to steal these things. They're just not available. So, Mo, why don't you introduce our guests, please?
Sure. I mean, I am really, really pleased to be able to introduce Dr. Saru Sharda. And I'm going to read off a bit of a background, and then we'll go right into some more broader questions. But Dr. Sharda is the inaugural Associate Dean of Equity Inclusion at the Faculty of Health Sciences at McMaster University. But I mean, this started, I'd say, just over a year ago. But she was also the inaugural Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Lead at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. That probably has been going on for about 3 or 4 years. But here's the other interesting point. In addition to her expertise, as you've heard, she is an anesthesiologist. She's a medical educator, a writer, and a trained creative writing coach. Now, Saru, let me ask you this. How did an anesthesiologist coach creative writer become the EDI lead master?
Oh, it's a big question, Mo. So, I mean, the creative writing, I think, has always been just a part of who I am. And I think what I've realized over time is actually storytelling and equity work are so closely intertwined. And there's so much that we can connect on. There's so much that we can, I think, see in a different way through narrative and through storytelling. So I actually use a lot of poetry and prose and storytelling when I'm talking about equity work and when I'm teaching equity work. So yeah, those two things have actually been a lot more intertwined and parallel than I thought they would ever be.
And from the perspective of doing the work you've done, was it something that just came naturally? Like in terms of like the work as an anesthesiologist, how did you, how did you ultimately get approached for the lead? Was it learning, quite a bit of learning along the way, or had you taken an early role as an advocate?
Yeah, I mean, I think both. So I had always had this sense of sort of justice and wanting the right thing to be done. I think that's sort of inherent in who I am. And then, of course, being the child of immigrants, I grew up in the UK where my parents had immigrated, you know, my dad in the 50s, actually. So one of the early sort of immigrants at that time. And, you know, really being exposed to a lot of racism and injustice and seeing that both overtly in terms of very overt racism. We would have graffiti written on our home. I remember the police having to come multiple times. And also observing my father, who was an engineer in academia, and some of the more insidious sort of discrimination that he went through in academia, which interestingly, I think ultimately pulled me back to academia in some way, influenced the journey, absolutely. And then I think what was the theoretical underpinning of it was when I was a junior resident, I undertook a master's in medical education, but also a fellowship at the Wilson Center at the University of Toronto, which many folks will know is a center of excellence for health professions education. And it was a really interesting time because I was surrounded by a whole bunch of education scientists, most of whom were not physicians. And I don't know if you folks have had this experience, but I find sometimes as physicians, we become pretty insular in our own little physician network. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up actually being supervised by two sociologists. And it just completely opened up my way of thinking and my way of knowing. And I used theories of power and hierarchy and identity formation in my thesis work and in my graduate work. And I think that ultimately then really led me to doing equity work, both from the perspective of lived experience and also from the perspective of really a theoretical background. And it's been interesting to see what has really changed in academia and what has really changed in the operating room over time and what really remains the same. And so that has been an interesting observation through doing this work for almost a decade now.
Mo, if I could just jump in, I think there may be people who are listening to this who have an interest in creative writing. And I was wondering, did you have formal training? Are you an English major or something like that? Or is it just something you've always pursued?
It's something I've always pursued. So I don't have formal training, but there was a time where I was taking a whole bunch of courses with a creative writing company. And I mentioned one day that, you know, I would love to sort of facilitate this kind of thing for physicians. I would love to sort of think about how it connects to advocacy work. And the person running the company said, well, you know what, you would actually be a great facilitator. Do you want to come and do some work for us? And I said, well, that's kind of impossible. I'm a physician. I was about to have my second child at the time. I think I was about 8 months pregnant when she approached me. And she said, well, you know, let's work something out. And so I did a whole training program with them to train as a creative writing coach. And then I actually got connected with the narrative medicine community at McMaster initially and then beyond, and then did some training in narrative medicine, which some people will be familiar with. And then it just sort of grew from there. And then, as I said, the intersections and the parallels between not just my equity work, but between clinical work as well and anesthesiology, and have hosted and run a whole number of workshops for clinicians, for other, you know, for physicians, for other healthcare professionals. And as I said, we've used it a lot in my equity and EDI work as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is really, really important. I can see that telling stories and being creative in the way we tell stories also helps share this message. I'm curious, actually, Saru, for the last 2 or 3 years that you've been doing this work at a leadership level, what have been, from your perspective, the challenges that you've faced or the misperceptions that maybe groups, particularly, let's say, in medicine, have about EDI?
Such a good question, Mo, because I think there are so many. And I think, again, once you've been doing this work for a while, you see the cycles repeating, right, of where the misperceptions sort of get acutely amplified. And I think we're sort of in that time period right now. I think one of the major misperceptions that I try to speak to directly is that this work, or the way that we approach this work, or the way we think about this work, is about good and bad people. And that it's a very dichotomous kind of, there are two ends of the spectrum, right? You're a good person who does equity work, or you're a bad person who doesn't. And really, that's very flawed, because really what equity work is about systems. It's about systems of oppression. It's about the way systems have come into being through various historical legacies. It's very rarely about good and bad people. I think most of us in healthcare are actually very altruistic people. It's why we do it, right? We actually really are dedicated to improving healthcare outcome. We're dedicated to our patients. And so really getting over this idea that, you know, if you don't get it, you're a bad person, rather than understanding that these things are so embedded into our systems that for us to actually understand it, it can be hard work and it takes some time, and that's okay, actually. And if you get it wrong, that's also okay. And actually, you will get it wrong. I get it wrong still all of the time. So this idea of a lifelong journey, not dissimilar to a lifelong journey for us as clinicians, you know, there's always new research coming out. There's always new things we're having to learn. It's not dissimilar. And I think the other big misconception is this idea that somehow we are taking away evidence-based, or the idea of merit doesn't hold true within equity work, right? Like we hear all the time, well, the diversity hire, or the, you know, and I think that's a big misconception. Really, what we're trying to do in equity work is think about, you know, the distance traveled. What have been the barriers for this person or this community compared to this person or this community? And what does that mean, therefore, in how we assess applications or how we assess merit? And so this is not about an either or, but rather, can we integrate different ways of knowing and being? Can we think about different definitions of excellence? It doesn't mean we're throwing the other definitions away. It just means we're trying to think about and versus or.
Go ahead, Mark.
I was going to just say that's extremely helpful. But I think many of us have been in a situation where we can't elevate the plane of discussion to the level that you just demonstrated. And there will be a comment made that, you know, that this is a promotion or this is a hire that is definitely not merit-based, da-da-da-da. You know, it's something that raises the hackles on us when we hear this. What suggestions do you have for us who have been experiencing these kinds of things, thankfully, rarely, but how do we elevate the plane of discussion in the heat of a short discussion like that?
Yeah, that's such a good question, Mark, and it comes up a lot. And in fact, I think what you're referring to is a microaggression. And that term microaggression sometimes is a bit of a misnomer because it's not actually micro. It can actually, as you say, be quite damaging and harmful. Yeah. And we actually wrote a paper about this recently, talking to your question of how do we address it in the moment. But importantly, what I think gets missed is we learn how to address it in the moment, but we don't learn about the system of oppression that led to it. So the clinical example I often use is the patient with diabetes comes to you with, you know, the gangrenous foot, which you folks are going to deal with surgically, perhaps. But if you don't actually get the glycemic control sorted out, you know, the other foot's going to get gangrenous too. So it's really about, yes, how do we deal with the gangrenous foot in the moment? And I can talk about that in just a second. But it's also about how do we go back and do some of that foundational learning and that foundational education around systems of oppression and where this came from, and therefore why we're seeing these symptoms, which are the comments that you talk about in the moment. And so I think for me, there's something about calling in versus calling out. And there's debate about this in the even within the equity world, right? There are some folks who are very much about you call that out, you know, you say in the moment that's not okay. And that certainly is necessary sometimes. But there's also the idea of calling in. And there's a racial justice activist named Loretta Ross who talks about this so beautifully. And if you have a chance to look at her work, I would highly recommend it. But there's something about approaching that with curiosity and saying, oh, it's interesting that you would say that. Why do you say that? Not dissimilar to how we, you know, teach our residents, you know, there's a diagnosis that clearly they've gotten wrong. Okay, tell me more. How did you get to that? And then to then go back and say, well, actually, let's look at the barriers that this person has likely faced based on research. I think that's what we have in the equity world now. We have tons of literature, which we can draw upon. So getting familiar with that is helpful. And then let's analyze this situation in the context of what we know. And so that's sort of the approach I would take. Sometimes things are egregious and have to be called out. Yeah. And sometimes you actually have to take a little pause. You know, maybe we all need to break for 5 minutes, you know, if things are getting really heated. I do try and use the calling in approach as much as I can initially and approach with curiosity and then build my own knowledge so that I can then refer to the literature that we know and the context that we know and sort of do a bit of education in that moment.
Extremely helpful. Mo, sorry for stepping on you.
Oh gosh, no, this is great. You know, hearing this discussion reminds me of back in, I guess it would have been 1990, where at McMaster, Gordon Guyatt and a group of other professors had, you know, they're promoting this idea of evidence-based medicine. Saru, you're well aware of it too. And I remember the significant challenge with moving in this direction, getting, you know, 99% of the people who weren't pretty skeptical about the idea to move forward. And the question that came up all the time is, this seems like a logical thing to do. It seems very rational. We're doing evidence-based medicine. Where's the evidence for evidence-based medicine? And I'm starting to see more similar types of questions coming up where everyone intuitively understands that, you know, being inclusive, you know, making sure we're diverse, you know, going towards equity. These are all very good concepts and very good to do. And then you'll have a group that'll say, well, is there evidence that using these policies and these approaches leads to some success? And however we design success. And I'm curious, Saru, you know, yourself being scholarly in this idea, what would you say to the idea of what is success and how do we even measure it?
Yeah. And you know, this comes up a lot in equity work. I was actually just having this conversation with a colleague yesterday over lunch. And as I was saying, you know, just a minute ago to Mark, what we have now that we didn't have 10 years ago when I started this work is actually we do have a lot of scholarly evidence now in this space. So it's really a question of I think for folks who are allies and accomplices, as you know, obviously you and Mark are, because we're here having this conversation, to become familiar with some of that. It doesn't mean you have to be experts in equity, but what you have to be is equity informed. And so if you're going to be scholarly in your approaches to your clinical work and to your leadership work, you have to be scholarly in your approaches to your equity work too. And so it behooves all of us in leadership positions to become familiar at least with some of this literature. So coming back to your question of what is success, Mo, for me, I think about that in different buckets, right? I think about myself as a clinician and I think about health equity. And we know now without shadow of a doubt that there are inequitable healthcare outcomes for marginalized communities. We know that. And we know that the root causes of that are usually racism, colonialism, transphobia, homophobia, you know, misogyny, all of those things. And this is where it's important for us to start to understand different ways of knowing and being. Because the clinical randomized control trial, which we consider the gold standard, that's not the gold standard that's going to get us to understand the outcomes and the successes in this space, which is why the Wilson Center experience was so transformational for me, because I started to really understand different ways of knowing and being and research from different types of scholars, which I never was exposed to in medicine. And so it takes us going outside of ourselves and outside of some of the normal literature that we would look at to really make sure we have this data at our fingertips. There's an excellent study actually in the Canadian Medical Association Journal by a colleague of mine in Ottawa, Dr. Jason McVicker, who's an anesthesiologist, and a group of his surgical colleagues, where they look at perioperative outcomes, and they looked at a database where they included almost 2 million participants, and they compared perioperative outcomes for Indigenous peoples versus non-Indigenous peoples. And they, you know, did all the research scholarly stuff that you folks are experts in and all the confounding things that they would have had to correct for. And they found a very, very significant stark difference in perioperative complications, perioperative mortality, access to certain surgical procedures, including joint replacement, actually. And the most important thing about that paper is when you read their conclusion, it's so beautifully expressed that these downstream healthcare outcomes that we're seeing and the disparities that we're seeing are directly consequences of colonialism, of residential school, of healthcare policy that continues on into, you know, these healthcare outcomes that we see. So part of success for me as a clinician is really getting to a point where we are not seeing disparity in healthcare outcome anymore, right? And then I think the other part of success for me, if I'm thinking as an academic and somebody who works at a university, is really, again, seeing that our leadership tables, that our faculty is getting to places where we truly are more diverse, and not just that we're more diverse, but where power is actually being shared. And what we know from the business literature, and Harvard Business Review has a number of articles on this, is that when you have organizations that are not only more diverse, but where power is actually shared, you see increased revenue generation, you see better retention, you see people who are happy being at work, you know, all of the things that we want as leaders. So that literature is there. And so I think those are some of the markers of success that we can look at.
Yeah, that's really, really helpful. Thank you so much for that.
It's been a wonderful discussion. I believe my colleague has one more question for you that we could head out on after this wonderful discussion. So Mo, I'm sure you've got one more.
Sure. And you know, and I'll leave this open-ended for you, Saru, because, you know, we are in January of 2024, so we have the year ahead of us. But as you look at if you do an environmental scan of what's happening around the world and the landscape, and particularly as we think about, you know, equity, diversity, and inclusion, what do you see as, you know, sort of the issues that we're going to have to deal with as whether we're in an academic institution or as individuals or within the healthcare system? In 2024, what are some of the broad themes that for you are areas of focus?
So I think certainly in the Canadian context, and I think the US is maybe a little bit ahead of us with this one, Mark, is looking at the importance of race-based data collection and looking at the importance of really, again, building that sort of evidence base for looking at disparities, whether they be in healthcare outcome or promotion and tenure or people who get to full professor, whatever you want to talk about in terms of the outcome. And really looking at not just the fact that we need to collect race-based data, and we need to be doing a much better job of that in Canada at least, but looking at how we do that ethically and well. So who owns that data, right? Who actually should have jurisdiction over that data? It's not us. It's the communities from whom we are actually getting that data and to whom ultimately we are accountable. So I think there needs to be a lot more focus on that. And there needs to be a lot more focus on how we actually partner with community and how we actually do that well. So I think those are two big areas of focus. I don't think we can have a conversation in January 2024 without realizing that we are in the middle of many political crises around the world, many humanitarian crises around the world. And I think healthcare institutions and institutes of higher education are still trying to grapple with, you know, what is our place in that? Recognizing that we have lots of people who are in pain right now on our campuses and in our hospitals for various reasons. And how do we speak to that in ways, in my mind, which center compassion and humanity? I think we get very sort of caught up in the politics of it all. And of course, that's important. But for me, if I think about who I am as an equity practitioner and who I am as a physician, as a mother, as a human being, I really think we need to turn our attention to how are we creating spaces for true dialogue. I just finished a course called the Sustained Dialogue course, which is actually based on a humanitarian advocate who did a lot of sort of peace talks and advocacy back in the 70s. But I think we've sort of lost a little bit of the core of our humanity in all of this. And yes, of course, I talk about systems, which are really important in systems of oppression. But I think just as much as we talk about systems, we have to come back to humanity and compassion. How do we actually be with one another? And maybe I'll just end with a bell hooks quote, which I come back to a lot, particularly when I'm struggling with my own sort of work and when we're in the midst of many crises around the world. And bell hooks says, how do we hold people accountable for their wrongdoing while simultaneously believing in their ability to transform? And I really think about that in equity work. How are we holding people accountable in very real ways and also believing that they can transform and we can transform together?
Fantastic ending. And I really appreciate your comment on data. And we at the Journal are all into that. We're about to report our diversity data across all of our editorial boards.
Amazing.
So, you know, you can't change what you can't measure. And we're reporting it in an editorial quite within the next 2-3 months. So and we will hold ourselves accountable to making sure we're measuring that. And we've also have a policy we're insisting on wherever possible. People need to report outcomes based on race and economic diversity, as well as sex and gender. Because these are really important metrics that we're not going to advance in this area unless we insist on reporting and analyzing these data. So thank you so much, Dr. Sharda, for an enlightening discussion. And be sure and check your mailbox for this priceless Ortho Joe mug.
Which I'll be waiting.
Shortly. Don't let anybody else check it because they might run away with that priceless mug.
Absolutely.
So thank you again for spending time with us. And
thanks so much, Rob. Thanks, Mo.
Maybe we'll have you on again in another year or two and see how we're progressing.
I would love that. And I'll bring my mug and we can talk about the data. That would be great.
Love
That's
it.
That's perfect.
Thanks so much, Dr.
Have a great day.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.